sidetracked, and they start worshiping other gods and doing other things that they shouldn't be doing, and God allows them to feel that, and a group comes in to oppress them so that they feel the pain of the decisions they've made. They cry out to God again, and God says, okay, I'm going to send you a judge to deliver you from this space. Over and over and over again is this pattern of this. And God finally says to David, that's going to end. Because you are going to finally make a kingdom for my people that is free from this influence so that they will finally know what it is to be a people and to be at peace. And that's what chapter 8 is. Making a kingdom that would be at peace. And twice in that chapter, God said, the Bible says that God gave him victory everywhere that he went. But this is where my wrestling came in. Really? Really, that's okay? It's okay to treat another human being that way? It's okay to lay them down by ropes and count them off and say, you guys are dying and you guys are good? And I struggled this week to get my head around that, to understand this holy, righteous, amazing, graceful, merciful God that would allow this to be. And then I had this moment of wondering, I wonder if that's true. Did David's actions not really go noticed by God? See, and we don't see that in chapter 8 or chapter 9 or chapter 10, really, but we see later in 2 Chronicles, I think it is, 1st, 2nd. David's passion, remember what I told you, was to build a temple. This honoring structure for God, because the temple would draw everyone to worship the Lord. It was such a passion of his that he had gathered supplies for it, materials of all kind. He'd drawn up plans. Now, if anybody's ever drawn up plans, that's a big deal. It's a lot of work, putting everything together so that the structure that we built would be the perfect honoring moment to who God is. He was good to go. And God said, no. You've been a man of blood, a man that has killed again and again and again, and it will not be you who builds the house of worship for me. God noticed how he accomplished it, and God held him accountable for what he had done. And David's response was an acceptance. How can he deny that? There was nothing he could say. Often, God gives us a thing that he wants us to accomplish. And there are many, many, many ways we can accomplish it. And sometimes, or a lot of times, God doesn't give us the details of how that has to be done. But we will always be held accountable for how we do it. And I guess for me, that's how I come up with peace for chapter 8. But the story I want to dig into today, the story I think that really fits with where things are at, happens in chapter 9. So if you want to turn to chapter 9, that's where we're going to go. Now, David had finally got peace within the kingdom. The end of chapter 8 says it was finally quiet and things were good, and he did everything that was right and just for the people who were there. And I think probably for the first time, he actually had time to process what had gone on in his life. I mean, he had been chased all over the wilderness by Saul. Saul and Jonathan had died. It took time to get all the tribes together to become a kingdom. Then he had to defeat all the enemies that were there. And finally, we have a kingdom where there is peace. And Israel is Israel. And David is able to take a step back and begin to process some of the things that he lost and some of the things that have gone on in that time. And so one day David asked, is anyone in Saul's family still alive? Anyone to whom I can show kindness for Jonathan's sake? And he summoned a man named Ziba who had been one of Saul's servants. Are you Ziba? The king asked. Yes, sir, I am, Ziba replied. The king then asked him, "Is anyone still alive from Saul's family? If so, I want to show God's kindness to them." Now, if you've been following our story with us, or if you've read this before, you know that Jonathan and David have been incredibly close friends. And I can't imagine how Jonathan had been in that space, wanting to honor the father that he had. His own dad is the king, and having David as his best friend. And as the conflict between Saul and David got stronger and stronger and stronger, it became more and more difficult for Jonathan to find a place to land in some ways. And it kind of came to a crux, to this moment of conversation where David says, "Your dad's out to kill me," and Jonathan says, "No, it can't be that bad." And David says, "No, seriously, your dad's out to kill me. I'm going to hide in a field. Here's the plan. You're going to go back. If I'm missing for a couple days, see what he does. And if he's all good with it, like, oh, no worries, it's fine, I'll come back. But if your dad loses it because I haven't shown up at this feast, you're going to shoot an arrow past me, and I'll know that I got to run." And John says, "I can't imagine my dad being like that, but okay, deal." He says, "But here's the thing. Promise me that you will take care of me and love me, even when the kingdom is yours. But if I die, treat my family with this faithful love, the love that we have between the two of us. Even when the Lord destroys all your enemies from the face of the earth, probably my dad, will you please take care of my family?" This conversation happened in a field where nobody else was making their plans. Nobody else could know this story because then it would no longer be a secret mission on Jonathan's part, so it was just them. Well, them and God, of course. So now we go back to where David is, and the kingdom is settled, and David remembers this conversation that he'd had with Jonathan. And it is of the utmost integrity that he chose to follow through, isn't it? Chose to live with honesty, chose to be himself in every place that he was, whole and complete, that he would say to himself, "This is something I need to follow up on now." And my guess would be, the surprises of advisors and the surprise of his family, he says, "This is what I need to do, because this is what I promised to Jonathan before God, and I will do everything I can to be open and honest and real." And it's one of those heartstrings that when it plays on a person's heart, everybody knows it. We live in a culture that's incredibly fluid when it comes to honesty and integrity. We don't even make it to appointments on time, and we'll decide that that's okay because this, this, and this happened. I'm sorry. We change things. We don't keep schedules well. We will allow someone else to believe the truth about something when it's not quite how it happened, but that's okay. We live in a world where our news we can't even honestly trust. Because to trust it, we'd have to figure out the bias of where it came from and who's saying what. And in that kind of culture, this kind of culture, to live with integrity speaks loudly to the people around us. In our business practices, in how we do life, making sure that our yes is yes and our no is no. And not having to say things like, "I promise." People should know what we say we will do. David had made this promise before God, and in his integrity, he's going to follow through on that. So this conversation is still with the servant. Ziba replied, "Yes, one of Jonathan's sons is still alive. He is crippled in both feet." "Well, where is he?" the king asked. "In Lodabar," Ziba told him, "at the home of Maker, son of Ammiel." So David sent for him and brought him from Maker's home. His name was Mephibosheth, and I'm probably going to say that wrong at some point today, just so you know. He was Jonathan's son and Saul's grandson. When he came to David, he bowed low to the ground in the deep respect. And David said, "Greetings, Mephibosheth." And Mephibosheth replied, "I am your servant." David said, "Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. See, From other accounts, we're told that Mephibosheth was 5 years old. When the news from the front came that his father and his grandfather, Jonathan and King Saul, had died on the battlefront. Now, they're dead. Everybody knows that David's going to become king next. What is your first response to all the rest of the family? You pick him up and you run. This kid is no longer safe. When it comes to intrigue and dynasty changes and things that are going on, the normal thing for a new king to do is to wipe out the competing kingdom. Done. So the nurse picked him up, took off running, and somehow in her flight dropped him. And both of his feet were damaged and never healed properly. So he was crippled in both feet. He had moved to a place that was out of the way, unseen, unheard, to protect him. But I think as he got older, just to keep his head down. You don't want to be known as the grandson of the king. You just want to live life. We can just make it through. I just want to live life and nobody will know. Hidden obscurity on purpose. And then out of the blue, one day, the messengers come. They're dragging you from your house saying, David wants to see you. You got to go. And so Mephibosheth is brought before David, and he kneels before David with the deepest respect. Here I am, and I have to imagine with absolute fear and trembling. Because the expectation would be that David would kill him on the spot. And how could he think any different? We just talked about the last chapter. David destroys his enemies, and not nicely destroys them. And this man that is hoping never to be seen or heard from again, just to live his life in quietness where nobody knows, is now before the king on his knees waiting for the verdict. And David could see it because his first words are, "Don't be afraid." Don't be afraid. I intend to show kindness to you because of my promise to your father, Jonathan. I will give you all the property that once belonged to your grandfather, Saul, and you will eat here with me at the king's table. Wait, did you see how I walked in here? Land? What good's land going to do me? Maybe more headache than it's worth, and I have to have hire people to take care of the land. And they'll cheat me, and they'll deal with me poorly, and land? Are you sure that's the plan? Mephibosheth bowed respectfully and exclaimed, "Who is your servant that you should show kindness to a dead dog like me?" Why would you do this? Every morning, I wake up, I go to get up, and I see my fate moving from bed to table to eat breakfast. I know who I am and what I am. I am the disgraced grandson of a king that is dead. Mephibosheth means mouth of shame. And I think you can feel that in him. Why would you notice a dead dog like me? A dog that maybe we drive by on the highway, we've done that, and you have compassion in the instant moment, you feel pity for that poor dog, and maybe the family that owned it, but you don't stop to do anything about it, you just keep going. Why would you notice a dead dog like me? I am nothing. I am less than nothing. I am pitied and have no ability on my own except for this man that has taken me in. The shame of who he was written all over him. And the king summoned Saul's servant Ziba and said, "I have given your master's grandson everything that belonged to Saul and his family. Everything. You and your sons and servants are to farm the land for him to produce food for your master's household. But Mephibosheth, your master's grandson, will eat here at my table." Not just will he be invited to eat at my table, but David provided people to take care of the land for him, who now were not just answerable to Mephibosheth and how they did life, but answerable to David. Here's the land. Here's what you look for. Here's who you are. Mephibosheth, I see you. David's heart for integrity and integrity for God to do the right thing, the promise he made, gave God a chance to bless this man who felt like he was unseen, unheard, and of no account to anybody. Worse, he was the enemy of the king of the land that he was in. But in that moment, Mephibosheth had a choice, didn't he? Choice to enter into that place and eat with the king, or to walk away. The beautiful thing about that choice being offered to him is it had nothing to do with who Mephibosheth was. Guy's name's so hard. He could have been the most embittered, unkind, ungracious, rude person to sit at that table who sat around looking at everything everybody else had, David's family, thinking the whole entire time, that could have been me. Or he could have been the most gracious, kind person sitting at that table, loving every second of the fact that he's now called a king's son, given the same rights as a king's son at that table. It didn't matter who he was. What mattered was the choice of David before God to do what he was supposed to do. None of it rested on him, but on the actions of God. And from that time on, Mephibosheth ate regularly at David's table, like one of the king's own sons. Mephibosheth had a young son named Micah, and from then on, all the members of Ziba's household were Mephibosheth's servants. And Mephibosheth, who was crippled in both feet, lived in Jerusalem and ate regularly at the king's table. No longer a man of shame, hidden in obscurity, but a man that could walk with identity. A man that could move from a nowhere place into Jerusalem and live there with his head held high because the king of that place had pulled him from there and put him at his table with his family, giving him a whole new identity and a whole new way to walk before everybody in that land, no longer an enemy of the king, but a son of the king. And as I was listening to this story and processing, I was thinking so much, it's just like what God does for all of us. We are broken, embittered, lost without God. Mentally, emotionally, with wounds that we just cannot heal, spiritually, with stuff that we know we do again and again and again before God that we have no way of cleaning up on our own, physically, where the scars of the choices that we've made with our bodies, living in shame and quiet corners of who we are because we just don't know how to deal with that. We don't know how to clean ourselves up because we can't. And it's the same God that saw Mephibosheth and through David brought him to the king's table that gave us Jesus to bring us to his table. That allows us to enter in into that family supper with everyone at the table. Daughter of the king, son of the king, equals in this place where the king has invited us to be. Jesus even told a story that was very much like that. A man prepared a great feast and sent out many invitations. When the banquet was ready, everything's good to go, he sent his servant to tell the guests, "Come, the banquet is ready." but they all began making excuses. One said, I've just bought a field and must inspect it. Please excuse me. Another said, I've just bought 5 pair of oxen and I want to try them out. Please excuse me. Another said, I just got married, so I can't come. Like Mephibosheth could have said, you know what, I'm happier in obscurity. I'm happier living where nobody knows who I am, where I don't have to face what happened in my life, all that I lost day after day, again and again. Leave me alone. And we do that with God sometimes. I think I can still figure this out. I think I can muscle through it. I think I can do this. God, we start making bargains. God, if you're not going to fix all the situation I'm in, I don't want anything to do with you. It's okay, I'm good without you. I mean, the rest of the story goes that Jesus, the man went out and went to everywhere to invite everybody in then. And the people that had first been invited were left out in the cold. See, when it comes to sitting at the banquet table, there's kind of a first choice about it, and then I think there's a daily one. First choice, the banquet, is to come, sit down, enter into my banquet. Enter into the goodness and fullness I have for you. But I think for some of us that have been believers for a long time, we forget that we're sitting at a full banquet table. We act like we're on the outside and that God hasn't given us everything that we need for every space that we're in. Now, I admit, we're not all like Mephibosheth, where God's going to take us out of a physical situation and put us in a new one. But Jesus does promise to change our inside, even in the midst of that situation. At Fine Arts Camp, we talked about that a lot. Jesus meets us in the middle of the storm. Jesus provides for our needs. Jesus is all that we need. Jesus still does miracles, and I could see the kids processing these stories based on what's happening for all these people that are really struggling right now. And again and again and again, we talked about miracles that had happened for people. Jesus still does those, but sometimes Jesus' biggest miracle is what happens on the inside of us, not on the outside. One of my favorite passages from the message is this one. It's the one I'm going to leave you with, because this is what Jesus wants to do for all of us. And I pray that even if it's a new invitation to the banquet, or if you've been sitting there for a while and you've forgotten it's all in front of you, that this would be what you'd know about our Savior. Are you tired, worn out, burned out in religion? Jesus says, come to me. Get away with me, and you'll recover your life. I'll show you how to take a real rest. Walk with me and work with me. Watch how I do it. Learn the unforced rhythms of grace. I won't lay anything heavy or ill-fitting on you. Keep company with me, and you'll learn to live freely and lightly.